So imagine waking up tomorrow, you turn on your PlayStation, and you realize the thousands of dollars you've spent on games over the last decade have just, well, vanished into thin air.
Right, just completely gone.
Welcome to the Deep Dive. We are looking at a stack of sources today from the July 6th, 2026 edition of Tekken Knight, and we are really exploring the I guess the overarching tension of our time.
Yeah, that friction between the miracles of modern tech and the costs.
Exactly. Because on one side, we've got these incredible boundary-pushing miracles, but on the other, there are these hidden costs you and I are paying in ownership, in privacy, and honestly, in cultural integrity.
It really is the defining friction of this decade. I mean, without a doubt,
Yeah.
because the stories we're unpacking today, they aren't just isolated industry updates. They represent this fundamental rewrite of the social contract between the companies building our digital world and, the consumers living in it.
And that means you listening right now. Whether you are a casual gamer, just passing time on a commute, or a developer, or really anyone using a modern web browser, these shifts are going to change how you interact with your devices.
Oh, absolutely. It affects everybody.
So, okay, let's unpack this. I want to start with that scenario I mentioned off the top, losing your library. So, Sony is officially ending physical PlayStation disc production in January 2028.
Right, which is a massive milestone.
It is. And Hideo Kojima, the creator of Metal Gear Solid and Death Stranding, he recently went viral, warning that this impending all-digital future is, quote, frightening.
And you really have to look at the historical data to understand why a veteran like him is sounding the alarm so loudly.
Yeah, lay out the numbers for us.
Well, between 1995 and 2005, physical sales were basically 98% of the market.
Wow, almost everything.
Exactly. But then during the pandemic, digital shifted to 75%. And now, Sony is drawing this hard line in the sand with the 2028 cutoff.
But isn't there a disconnect there? I thought people still liked physical media.
That's exactly where the friction comes from. The consumer data shows that 65% of gamers actually still prefer physical copies.
Okay, wait, let me play devil's advocate for a second here.
Sure, go ahead.
Isn't buying a digital license today just the like the modern equivalent of buying an arcade token in the 80s? I mean, we never actually owned the Pac-Man arcade cabinet.
Right.
We just paid a quarter for the experience.
Yeah.
So why is a digital storefront any different from that?
Well, the difference is the illusion of permanence. When you put a quarter in an arcade machine, the transaction is physically self-contained, right? It's immediately concluded.
Okay, good.
But a digital storefront, it intentionally mimics a physical library. You have a digital shelf, you have the box art, you literally click a button that says buy.
But you're not actually buying it, are you?
No, mechanically, all you are purchasing is a database entry on a remote server. You hold a revocable license. If you buy a physical disc, the code is literally pressed into it. You can put it on a shelf, play it offline a decade later, lend it to a friend.
But with digital.
With a digital game, it requires a constant handshake with a central server to verify your permission to play.
Okay, so if the server goes down, the game goes down. I mean, it's like buying a house, moving your furniture in, and feeling like it's totally yours.
Yeah, that's a good way to look at it.
But then you read the fine print and realize you've just signed a revocable lease.
Yeah.
And a few years later, the bank decides, hey, we want to remodel the neighborhood.
So they just evict you.
Right. They just come by, change the locks on your front door, and walk away. And you have zero recourse.
Precisely. And this isn't just some hypothetical threat, it is an active preservation crisis right now.
The Video Game History Foundation actually put out a really staggering statistic in these reports.
Oh, the 87% number.
Yeah.
Yeah.
87% of classic American games are already legally inaccessible. Like, you just cannot purchase them anywhere.
It's devastating for preservation. Future historians and players simply will not be able to experience the media of this era, basically because it's locked on servers that companies have quietly unplugged.
Which means if you don't actually own the media, the platform owner completely dictates access. They don't just decide if you get to play, they decide who gets to play.
Exactly. They hold all the cards.
And we are seeing that mechanism weaponized right now. Sony just blocked the PC version of their new fighting game, Marvel Toucan, Fighting Souls, on Steam in 132 countries.
Yeah, the scale of that blockade is just massive.
It's huge. We are talking about Egypt, Nigeria, Ukraine, Bolivia. I mean, The Philippines alone has over 40 million gamers who are completely locked out of this release.
And it's all because of a new mandate requiring PC players to link a PlayStation Network or PSN account to their Steam profile.
But here's where it gets really interesting, because the Tech & Night piece points out a glaring hypocrisy here.
Right, the console availability.
Exactly. The game is available on the PlayStation 5 in these exact same countries. So this obviously isn't a technical hurdle.
No, not at all. It is entirely a business choice. And honestly, Sony is repeating the exact same public relations disaster they triggered a few months ago with Helldivers 2.
Oh yeah, they attempted this same mandatory linking and faced a global revolt over it.
And yet here they are doing it again.
Sony's official PR line is that this account linking is strictly for, you know, security and moderation, keeping the community safe from toxic players.
Right, that's the claim.
But I have a really hard time buying that. I mean, when a corporation is willing to forfeit sales in 132 countries just to enforce a login, isn't this really just a massive data harvesting operation?
Well, the analytics strongly suggest that data is the primary motive here. Platform holders really want to cross-reference your Steam data with your PlayStation data.
So they can see everything you're doing.
Exactly. By linking those accounts, they can build incredibly detailed marketing profiles. They track your play patterns, your social graph, your purchase behaviors across multiple ecosystems.
They basically just want to force everyone into this walled garden where they own the telemetry.
Yes, and the consumer base is well aware of it. The sentiment analysis in our sources shows a 78% negative reaction across forums.
78% is huge.
It is. The frustration stems from watching a global medium get artificially fractured, you know, just to satisfy internal corporate metrics.
So Sony is using their platform to gatekeep global players and harvest data. But, you know, the entire strategy assumes the platform itself is actually a secure walled garden.
Right, which is a very dangerous assumption.
Because what happens when the gatekeeper's own walls have invisible holes in them?
And that leads perfectly into the vulnerability exposed in our next source.
The Opera GX thing, right?
Yes. A catastrophic security flaw was just patched in Opera GX, which, for those who don't know, is a highly popular web browser marketed specifically to gamers.
And the flaw allowed malicious websites to auto-install add-ons without a single user click, which, I have to say, completely breaks my mental model of internet security.
Oh, it breaks most people's mental models.
Right. Because I always thought if I didn't actively click download or, you know, hit an accept button, my system was generally safe. Mm. How does an extension just install itself?
Well, to understand how this happened, you have to look at the underlying architecture of how browsers handle external requests.
Okay, lay it on me.
The vulnerability exploited something called an unvalidated protocol handler.
A protocol handler? What is that exactly?
Think of it like a digital traffic cop. Normally, when you click a link on a website that says something like open in Spotify, that link isn't standard web code. It's a specific protocol.
Ah, I see.
So the browser acts as the traffic cop. It checks the ID of that request, verifies it's safe, and then hands it off to the Spotify app on your computer.
Okay, so the browser is managing the handoff between the web and your local machine.
Right. But in Opera GX, this specific traffic cop was essentially asleep on the job. The protocol meant to handle simple actions just wasn't properly validated.
Wow, wow.
So attackers created a script that basically drove right past the checkpoint. By simply visiting a compromised website, the site could send a command through this handler that instructed the browser to silently install an extension in the background.
That is terrifying. It's literally like installing a multi-million dollar state-of-the-art security system on your house, but you just leave a digital doggy door wide open.
Yeah, exactly.
And an invisible thief just crawls right through the doggy door and empties your safe while you're sitting in the living room watching TV. You have no idea it's even happening.
That is a highly accurate way to visualize the breach. And once that extension was inside, the damage was total.
Because of permissions, right?
Exactly. Browser extensions are designed to read and modify the web pages you visit, so they require incredibly high-level permissions.
Right.
This silent install gave attackers total access to session cookies, saved passwords, browsing history, even banking information.
Now, to be fair, Opera did move fast here. The sources say they released a patch within 48 hours.
They did.
And they introduced this new Pace Protect feature to guard against these kinds of click fix attacks moving forward.
They did, but this really highlights a structural reality of modern software. I mean, a web browser contains millions of lines of code.
So bugs are just inevitable.
Imperfections are a mathematical certainty. Security is not a state you achieve and then just lock in. It is an endless reactive game of cat and mouse.
which is concerning enough when it's just your personal banking info at risk. But let's scale this up a bit.
Oh, the scale definitely gets bigger today.
Because what happens when these kinds of code vulnerabilities become actual tools of national security? The Tech and Night reports detail this massive geopolitical shift happening right now.
The Alibaba situation.
Yeah. Alibaba, the Chinese tech giant, just banned all of its employees from using Anthropic's Claude code, which is a highly advanced AI coding assistant.
And they replaced it with an internal tool called Coder.
Exactly. And this is where software architecture intersects with the tech Cold War, right?
It really is. Chinese researchers discovered what they categorized as a fingerprinting backdoor inside Claude code.
Okay, wait. How exactly does fingerprinting work in this context? Because it sounds like spy movie stuff.
It's essentially a background data gathering mechanism. The code was actively pinging the host system to pull environment variables.
Like what kind of variables?
Specifically IP addresses, time zones, and the default language of the operating system. It aggregates those data points to determine with very high accuracy exactly where in the world the user is physically located.
So it's like buying a high-tech corporate filing cabinet, only to discover the manufacturer installed a GPS tracker in the metal to ensure it never leaves the country.
Or, more accurately, a filing cabinet that checks its own GPS coordinates before the drawer will even unlock for you.
Wow. Okay, but we need to look at this impartially, because both sides have very strong stances here.
Right, the context here is absolutely crucial.
So on one side, Anthropic defends this mechanism by stating it is strictly for compliance with United States tech export laws.
Yes, the U.S. government has severe, legally binding restrictions on exporting advanced AI capabilities to China.
So Anthropic is arguing they are legally obligated to ensure their services aren't being accessed in restricted regions, and this fingerprinting is just a standard compliance check.
But from Alibaba's perspective, having an American AI tool secretly pulling system data from Chinese enterprise servers is a massive data harvesting risk.
Right. In the context of global espionage, they view it as an unacceptable vulnerability. Hence, the total ban.
Exactly. It's a clash of national security priorities.
So if Alibaba is blocking Claude and Anthropic is actively tracking where its AI is being used, I mean, are we basically watching the internet fracture in real time? Like a digital Berlin Wall?
We really are witnessing the end of the global internet as a unified concept, especially regarding AI. Tech companies are caught squarely in the middle of this.
Because they want global users, right?
They want access to global user bases, yes. But they are constrained by export controls on one side and data sovereignty laws on the other. It fundamentally changes how open source development works.
How so? Like, mechanically?
Well, historically, a developer in Shenzhen, a developer in Silicon Valley, and one in Berlin could all iterate on the exact same foundational code base, compounding global innovation.
Right, the global commons.
But if developers are legally walled off from using certain tools, we fragment into completely isolated spheres of technology.
So you're saying we're going to end up with completely different ecosystems?
You will have a distinctly American AI ecosystem, a Chinese ecosystem, and likely a European one. And each will operate with totally different standards, capabilities, and, you know, inherent biases.
Man, so we are seeing nations physically fracture along technological lines. But AI isn't just dividing geopolitical borders, is it?
Not at all.
It's creating incredibly deep cultural divides about what it actually means to be human. Which brings us to Google's July 4th commercial.
This is such a fascinating case study in technological capability clashing with human sentiment.
So for Independence Day, Google released an ad campaign showing the American founding fathers using Google Workspace and the Gemini AI to write the Declaration of Independence.
The tagline was, group project, but make it 1776.
Yes. And they went all in on the concept. The ad shows Benjamin Franklin setting up deadline reminders on Google Calendar. John Adams is joining the constitutional debate via Google Meet from Boston.
And then there's the part that really sparked the backlash.
Right. Thomas Jefferson is typing the document, and Gemini AI drops down a predictive text box suggesting he use the word inalienable instead of unalienable.
And the public reaction to this was immediate and highly polarized.
Definitely.
If we look at the supporters of the ad, they view it as a clever, harmless celebration of modern collaboration.
Like, it's just a fun tool.
Exactly. In their view, the founding fathers are still doing the deep philosophical thinking, but the AI is just removing the logistical friction, demonstrating how technology can facilitate human effort.
But on the flip side, the detractors viewed it as fundamentally insulting to human history.
Yeah.
And honestly, I kind of understand the friction there.
How so?
Well, the Declaration of Independence is viewed as this profound human achievement born out of intense debate, courage, real philosophical struggle.
Right. It's a deeply human artifact.
Exactly. So the detractors argue that implying a document of that magnitude was co-authored by an algorithmic suggestion like a machine trained to just predict the next most likely word in a sequence, it diminishes the soul of the work.
It substitutes a messy historical human debate with sterilized predictive text.
It's like using an AI image generator to create a paint-by-numbers version of the Sistine Chapel ceiling.
That's a great analogy.
I mean, sure, the AI might technically get the paint on the ceiling faster and more efficiently than Michelangelo did, but it fundamentally misunderstands the physical struggle, the raw emotion, and the overarching purpose of the masterpiece.
And that tension is something Google has repeatedly struggled to navigate. I mean, they actually had to pull an ad recently showing a father using AI to write a fan letter for his daughter to an Olympic athlete.
Oh, I remember that. People hated that.
There is a profound lack of cultural intelligence occurring alongside their technical brilliance. They are really struggling to understand when consumers actually want algorithmic help-like auto-formatting a spreadsheet versus when they find algorithmic intervention emotionally offensive.
Like writing a love letter or a foundational historical document.
Exactly. It crosses the line.
It's the difference between a tool that helps humanity and a tool that tries to replace humanity.
Absolutely.
But I do want to pivot here. Because we've spent a lot of time on the bleak side of this tension today.
We have covered a lot of heavy stuff.
The loss of digital ownership, the regional gatekeeping, browser threats, the AI culture wars. But despite all of that, the raw power of the hardware itself is still breaking barriers.
It is. And to see that, we look back to the gaming industry, specifically a recent statement from Square Enix.
Yes.
During a shareholder meeting, they were asked about the possibility of bringing their massive role-playing game, Final Fantasy XV, to the upcoming Nintendo Switch 2 console.
And their official response was that a port is, quote, not entirely impossible.
Which is such a careful corporate phrase.
Right. Not entirely impossible. But let's contextualize why that is actually a wild engineering statement. Final Fantasy XV is a 55-gigabyte behemoth of an open-world game.
It's massive.
It was built on the Luminous engine, which was designed specifically to push high-end cinematic graphics on powerful home consoles. So the idea of taking that architecture and porting it to a handheld device you can play on a bus, it's a colossal technical challenge.
Oh, it's a massive hurdle.
How does that actually work mechanically?
Well, it requires a massive leap in mobile chip architecture. The rumors indicate the Switch 2 will feature a custom NVIDIA Tegra chip.
Okay.
Historically, mobile chips prioritize battery life over raw compute power. But modern ARM architecture has advanced to the point where this new Tegra chip is rumored to rival the processing power of a PlayStation 4 Pro.
In a handheld. That's insane.
It is. And given that hardware, Square Enix really has four potential mechanisms to make this port happen.
Okay, let's break those down. What's the first option?
The first option is a cloud version. The game runs on a massive server farm somewhere else, and the video feed simply streams to the Switch 2 over the internet.
But that requires a constant high-speed internet connection, which completely kills the portability aspect of a handheld. Like, you couldn't play it on a plane.
Right, which isn't ideal. So the second option is a native port with downscaled graphics.
Meaning they just make it look worse.
Essentially, yes. The developers go into the code and aggressively compress the texture resolutions, lower the frame rate, and reduce the polygon count of the models. It's similar to how they squeezed The Witcher 3 onto the original Switch.
Okay, that makes sense. Option three.
A pocket edition approach.
Oh, I've seen those.
Yeah. Instead of using the hyper-realistic cinematic graphics, they rebuild the game using simplified, stylized art assets. It tells the exact same story and has the same gameplay mechanics, but requires a fraction of the processing demand.
Got it. And the fourth option?
The fourth option would be episodic releases. Literally taking the massive open-world game code and physically splitting it into smaller, manageable chunks that players download one at a time.
Man, we've spent this entire deep dive looking at artificial limits.
Yeah.
You know, Sony blocking countries, the AI walled gardens, revoking digital licenses.
Right.
But this story is about shattering physical hardware limits. If a massive, complex simulation like Final Fantasy XV can genuinely be processed natively in the palm of our hands, Doesn't this finally erase the line between the home console and handheld gaming forever?
It really represents the absolute culmination of hardware convergence. And if you look at the history, Square and Nintendo had a notoriously chilly relationship for years after Square moved their games to the CD-ROM-based PlayStation in the late 90s.
Oh, right, the big split.
But modern chip technology is advancing so rapidly that it is making once impossible photorealistic environments viable absolutely anywhere. It is fundamentally changing the paradigm of how and where we are able to consume high-end digital media.
It really is a genuine technological miracle amidst all the friction we've talked about.
But it gives you some hope.
Exactly. So let's synthesize the journey we've been on today. We started with Kojima's fight for physical ownership against an impending all-digital future.
Right.
We looked at how that lack of ownership allows platforms to arbitrarily gatekeep 132 countries. We explored the terrifying silent security flaws hidden inside our web browsers and the geopolitical battles tearing the tech world apart as AI fractures along national borders.
It's all connected.
It is. We unpacked the cultural missteps of AI encroaching on human history. And finally, we looked at the incredible hardware miracles promised by the next generation of mobile chips.
It is a vast, incredibly complex digital landscape out there.
And it's one you are navigating every single day. The overarching takeaway here is that every time you click agree to a digital license, or every time you choose an AI tool or buy a piece of hardware, you are actively participating in these crossroads.
You are.
You are casting a vote for who controls the future of tech.
And as we look toward that future, I want to leave you with a final thought to mull over, kind of building on Kojima's feels about preservation and Google's ambitions with AI.
I'd love to hear it.
Think about this. If our physical media completely disappears by 2028 as projected, and our foundational documents, our personal letters, and our creative works are increasingly co-authored by algorithms trying to predict what we want to say, what exactly will the digital artifacts of our current era look like a century from now?
Wow.
When future historians try to study us, will they find the true, messy, beautiful human experience? Or will they just find the sanitized, algorithmically generated data left behind by corporate servers?
That is a chilling but deeply necessary question to end on. Keep questioning the digital world around you. Keep demanding better. And thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Until next time, make sure you know exactly who holds the keys to your digital house.